So were you actually packed for Japan?
I actually packed 3 days ago.
Did you really?
And my stuff's all still packed in. It's nicely folded up. And I think that's why I'm wearing today, because all my good stuff's actually packed away.
Do you have to share a room when you go over there?
No. I have an apartment.
What?
I have an apartment for the whole time.
So you are actually on holiday?
Are you joking?
Why do you need an apartment?
Because I'm there for that long. I need to be able to do my washing, my ironing. I'm actually, do you know what? Genuinely, I'm taking my computer.
You have never done any washing or ironing in your life.
I need to do it now.
So here we are, mate, back for the sixth episode of After the Whistle. Over the last five episodes, we've interviewed other people. We've talked about their journeys, champion mindset, you know, how they've dealt with resilience, leadership, etc. But we've never spoken about our own journeys. So I thought today would be quite a nice opportunity to do that, you know, explore those journeys a bit further.
I've certainly learned bits about you and myself in comparison to other people's journeys. So it'd be good just to get beneath the bonnet. Is that a saying?
Get deep inside.
Get beneath the bonnet? Lift the bonnet?
Beneath the bonnet.
That is a saying in my house. In my house, that's a saying.
Are you a mechanic?
Yeah.
A car jacker, we're gonna go, maybe, we're gonna not a mechanic.
We're going to go for a deep dive.
For a deep dive.
I'm have you crying within 10 minutes.
That's worrying for everyone. We should probably start by saying you failed in your mission, which was to get to Japan and send us an intro from one of the greats of the game over there, you know. So what's happened? Why are you sat here with us today?
Sadly, I'm sure everyone's aware, the typhoon that hit Tokyo meant that my flight got cancelled. So I'm currently on standby waiting to go out. So it's not my fault. Force majeure, world, you know, I can't really be held responsible for that. But you're right, I have failed. I didn't get a recording from over in Tokyo, but hopefully I'll be there within the next few days.
Yeah, well, you didn't apologize, but you know, I'll accept it.
Okay, thank you.
And we're talking about the typhoon, so we should be serious for a minute. And the game went ahead. You know, there was some fantastic decision making, I think, by World Rugby to call off the games on Saturday. It was about safety. Ultimately, 28 people died in the typhoon. So obviously our thoughts are with everyone that was seriously affected by it. So with that in mind, you know, how did you feel that World Rugby and the handling of the typhoon was? You know, you're going to be out there hopefully tomorrow. You're going to be on a flight in the next few days at the very least. How do you think the handling and the perception has been?
I think it's been really good. I think it's been top draw. And I say that as someone who was supposed to fly and land bang in the middle of when the typhoon was hitting. And I don't think I really appreciated how big it was, because they were asking me, am I still okay to fly? And I go, yeah, that'd be fine. I'm sure it will pass. And then when I looked on the
oh, you were asking the
yeah, they're asking okay. And I didn't realize how dangerous and how big it was until I actually saw some of the clips on social media. And I'm so glad that it was cancelled, and because it's just horrendous, some of the stuff that we've seen.
And obviously the Japan-Scotland game, which was the big talking point, wasn't it? You know, there were other games during the course of the weekend, but the fact that Japan-Scotland, which had so much riding on it, was possibly going to be called off. How do you feel? Because I know Scotland reacted, you know, as probably any team would during the course of, you know, the pivotal moment in your playing career. Some players will only get to play in one World Cup. And the opportunity that might have been taken away from them, that chance to progress to the quarterfinal. But how do you feel Scotland reacted to that? Because there was a point where they were saying they'd threaten legal action if the game didn't go ahead or wasn't moved.
I think as a player, you focus on the Saturday. You're there to win. You're there. You know, World Cup is a huge from the pinnacle of your career. Once every 4 years, obviously. And like you said, a lot of people, if they're lucky enough to go to one World Cup, they may not get another chance. So from a player's perspective, I think they'll just be wanting to get the game done. From Scotland, as a union's perspective, that's 4 years worth of work down on that one match. So I can see the frustration. And you look at it and think, well, what would England do if we were in that situation? As players, we look at it saying, we want to play the game. Mm. Obviously, we want to play the game. But as a union, as a country, as a nation, we'd want to, if that was us leaving the tournament, then you'd be absolutely devastated. And you'd be, I felt for them as they led into it. And then obviously the game was the game and the result was the result. But I think it was so good and testament to everyone who's involved in over in Japan, how they managed to get that fixture on.
I think the Japanese had a bit of a statement to make, didn't they? Especially because you got the build up to Tokyo Olympics next year, to say that, look, whatever's thrown at us, we can deal with. You know, I don't necessarily, oh, it's easy now. I can look at it. I'm not in the bubble that Scotland are in. I think I was a little bit disappointed that Scotland started threatening legal action and all those things. Obviously, thankfully, it didn't transpire that it was needed. World Rugby made some really good, clear decisions. taking all the right advice on board. But actually, one of the things I found out, and I don't know if you saw any of the social media stuff, but when Japan went out and Scotland went out for their team run on the morning before, that they had to wade through about, you know, it was up to the thigh depth in water as they were going out onto the pitch. So as they came down the tunnel, they went up onto the pitch. There was like a little depression. And that's because the stadium was built on stilts. So the stadium itself acted as a flood defense because it allowed water to seep through the stadium. And actually, I think, you know, that's probably why it filled up, because it was literally passing through. So the stadium itself is, they're clever, the Japanese, aren't they? They're literally preparing for every eventuality. But it was quite interesting to watch.
And they're used to it. They know, it's not like if that would happen here, then I don't think we'd have had the, you know, we haven't got the infrastructure in place. We get a little bit of snow, the whole country closes down. So I think that they know that they did as much as they possibly could. And I know, I was speaking to people out there. I was speaking to Martin Johnson and just exchanging texts, and even Joe Worsley, to the boys. So I was supposed to meet with Joe Worsley, if you remember, Joe and Graham Rowntree. And that didn't happen because they couldn't actually fly into Tokyo. They were stuck where they played their matches. And I was saying, what's it like? And they were saying it's horrendous. Like their transport stopped. And so to go from that and then seeing the video clips to then seeing the match play. And also you look at the surface that it was played upon. The surface was amazing. It was firm. I thought it would get cut up, but it didn't. It held true. So yeah, like, you know, it's typhoon season, but they had things in place, the defense mechanisms or whatever you like, were in place to make sure that the match could go ahead. So yes, some games were canceled. If that game had been canceled, I think it would have been a huge talking point forever. But thankfully it went on, and I'm sure it's still going to be a talking point forever anyway for the Scottish.
Well, ultimately the same outcome materialised, didn't it? So Japan were top of the group prior to that game, and they finished top of the group afterwards. And not only did they finish top of the group, it was a quality match from both sides. I mean Japan have been my sort of, I love an underdog story. I've wanted Japan to go through all along. But watching the match and watching the manner in which they played, I thought was really exciting for just the game of rugby as a whole. What was your take on it?
I thought they were clinical. I thought they deserved to get, you know, the match itself. You saw them as they came out, how tight they were as a unit. And also I think all the media is saying there's a conspiracy theory that it worked in Japan's favour if the game gets cancelled, because it meant they go through by default. Yeah. And I think it was a statement for them to play the match, to show that it wasn't a fluke, that they've won 3 out of 3 and now they've won 4 out of 4 and topped the pool. So I think for them, it was massive. It was massive. Then I'm actually going out. So when I do land there, I'm going to watch their quarterfinal against South Africa.
Oh,
so
what game that'll be.
If I had to pick a quarterfinal to watch out of all of them, that would be the one. I'd want to watch Japan, the host nation, playing against South Africa, who they last time they played each other, they won. So for me, I think I've got, and I picked that match a long time ago. So I think I'm pleased it's worked out that
Give
way.
Give yourself a pat on the back, mate. Hey, well done. Well done. Love a bit of self-praise. Yeah, well, you've well got done, full well James done. Haskell on it. Oh, look at me, Leon Lloyd, such a legend.
I saw it in the future.
You should have gone into betting, mate, or gambling. You would have been brilliant. But I mean, so let's talk a little bit more about that game in particular, because Scotland have this unbelievable habit. I mean, they've got some wonderful players, you know. You look at Stuart Hogg, for instance. I know he's always spoken about and had a reasonable game, but for whatever reason, they never seem to turn up until they go behind. You go back to the Six Nations last year when England were dominating proceedings at Twickenham in the first half, and then everyone thought it was going to be a 50 or 60 point drubbing. But all of a sudden, Scotland turn it on and come back and get a draw in the second half. Almost the same transpired in the match against Japan. It wasn't until they went behind and, you know, Fukuoka scored 2 tries either side of halftime for Japan. But he was, their play was absolute quality. But they went into halftime, Japan, essentially, and Scotland were out of the game. Why do they have to go behind so far?
Do you know what? Before the game kicked off, and for the reasons I just said about how they came out, they looked united, they looked tight here in Jamie Joseph's interview, I thought this is going to be a Japanese victory. And then Scotland started and they scored that textbook try, the kick to the corner, the gather, the score in the corner. And I thought, this is a different Scotland. They're up for this. And I found myself changing, thinking this could be a bit of a hiding because Scotland are on it. Then they reverted back to the Scottish team that you've just referred to then, about sort of going behind and sort of getting the lead and then absorbing it as opposed to keep building upon it, where the Japanese didn't stop. They went 7-0 down in a massive game. They came back, scored, they scored again. I don't know. I think Scotland, I suppose because they're, a lot of the time they are the underdog. Maybe that's because they've sort of, we know we've talked about that in the past about the Irish side. You know, that when they're favourites, they tend not to play as well as we know they can play. It's when they are the underdog, they come back and play. So maybe they should start with less points.
And is there an argument now? Obviously, there's so many teams that have played well. Okay, there have been some, when Namibia played New Zealand, there have been, you know, maybe some higher score lines, you know, in the 70s. But actually, Uruguay, Georgia, Namibia, Japan, the progress that they've made as nations, rugby playing nations, has been huge. Is there, you know, is there an argument, do you think? And if there is there an argument to promote any of these sides to the Six Nations over Italy, or just promote them anyway and make it the Seven Nations?
I think there's consistency is key. The reason why Italy joined the Five Nations because they were consistently performing at a decent level. The reason Argentina joined, you know, with the Southern Hemisphere or the Tri-Nations, yes, is because they consistently played well and they occasionally turned a team over. If you look at the likes of Japan, then there's, you know, there is an argument to say if they're consistently beating teams, which they have done, they finished top of their group, they played four, won four. So there is an argument, you know, a strong argument to say that they should be given the opportunity. Where that fits in with time zones and everything else, I don't know. But the chance to play against Japan in a tournament on a regular basis, how could that be?
That, mate, that would be great. And great for the game as a whole. But so there were more games than just Japan, Scotland. Over the weekend, obviously, Australia beat Georgia, but Georgia had a fantastic display. Mamouk Gugodzi's last game, who's been an absolute colossus for Georgian rugby over the last decade. Uruguay, of course, made it really hard for Wales. Wales ultimately got the best of Uruguay. Uruguay really impressed me during the course of this competition. They Tonga beat USA, and it was Callum Afoni's and Pia Tau's last game in Tongan colours, and they were carried off the pitch by the teammates. Not something that ever happened to you or me, sadly.
Oh, I did. I got carried off lots of times on a stretcher.
Yeah. Knocked out by your own teammates, sadly. But, you know, for players retiring, you know, how big an occasion was that for those guys just to leave? And
yeah, to go out on the top, to go out in a World Cup. Obviously, the ultimate is to go out winning the World Cup, obviously. But those guys, realistically, I'm assuming they wouldn't have thought they were going to win the World Cup. So to go out after a good performance and sort of having the respect shown to you by the crowd and the occasion, you know, they're memories, aren't they? The reason we play this game is, you know, is to create memories, and they're ones that they'll take with them and share with their kids.
Nice. And some of the memories that Gary Gold probably wouldn't have wanted was to equal the USA's losing streak of 10 matches on the bounce. They'll be pretty disappointed with that performance. But look, let's not dwell on those. We've got quarterfinal matches coming up. Let's have a little glimpse into what's going to be ahead next weekend, because this is properly exciting. You've got England v Australia. You know, some would say England v the old enemy. You know, we've played them so many times in competitions. What do you think about that? There's a couple of key players, from my point of view, that England are going to have to do away with, and that's Hooper and Pocock, the two noses at the breakdown. Do you think they've got the capability of doing that?
I think they have. I think they're not new. They've been a solid performers for Australia for many years, so England will know how to do that. I think what England will be good at doing is sticking to their own game plan, and I think if they do that, as we've seen in the previous matches, this should be a convincing win. And I don't want to give them the curse, but they're fresh. So it might take them a little bit of time to get into the game, because they've played one less game. But I think if they stick to what they've been doing and their game plan, then I see it as a convincing win for England.
And if they win there, likelihood is they go on and play New Zealand.
Do you think New Zealand are going to beat Ireland?
I do think Zealand will beat Ireland. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, on paper, you would think that. I think Ireland might have their World Cup match in the quarterfinal.
I mean, they've been so poor during the course of this tournament. I just think, you know, they always build up to World Cups and they always under-deliver. But you might be right. You know, every team is capable of one big performance. But the fact that Ireland have only ever beaten the All Blacks once, and that was, what, 2 years ago in Boston, in the entire history of their international, you know, years, I just can't, I actually don't think they believe they can beat the All Blacks. They'll say it in the press, won't they? They say, oh, yeah, we can definitely, you know, it's all about one game.
I don't know. I you know what? We could be talking about this next week and you could be laughing at me because New Zealand can put 50 points on them.
Absolutely. However, bump them.
If for England to win the World Cup, this is my own personal view, then it would do them very well if Ireland beat New Zealand. Because I think that Ireland would win that match and they'd be plain sailing. They think they're plain sailing, and then it would come along and...
Yeah. Well, mate, that's fair enough. I can't agree with you. I can't see New Zealand beating Ireland, but everyone's entitled to their own opinion. Yours is wrong, mine's right.
You just said you can't see New Zealand beating Ireland, did you say? So you're actually agreeing with me.
Did I say that?
You did. Didn't matter. Anyway.
I can't see Ireland beating New Zealand. I genuinely can't. My brain obviously does. Subconsciously, I believe.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, just
so
loyalty
say,
to the Northern Hemisphere and something like
times,
that.
It would be true.
I'm saying that, but I would actually love to see a change in the two finalists rather than South Africa, New Zealand, which in my heart of hearts, is probably what I believe will be the outcome of the final. That being said, you know, Wales play France. If Wales sneak past France, then they may end up playing South Africa or Japan. Either one of those sides, I believe Wales feel they could beat, and then they'll find themselves in a World Cup final. And once you're there, all bets are off, aren't they? You know, it's just the game and who turns up on the day to deliver. But let's look at that one, Wales v France. Where do you see that going?
I say France would be fresh, obviously having one less game. That could work against France. You know, we say it all the time, on their day, France can beat anybody. Yeah. They've not had their day yet.
It's boring saying
it,
that,
it,
though,
is, it? It is, but we're both, you've been, I'm sure you've been on the, I certainly have been on the receiving end of a true underdog French team where you're thinking to turn them over, and they actually come out and it's just a different team, absolute different team. Wales didn't play that well their last game, so there'll be people playing for positions going forward as well. So I'm sure they'll have got a bit of a dressing down at training this week leading into this match. It's massive.
That was a second team that they put out, though. But you're right, you know, every team you put out, you expect to deliver, don't you? Yeah. So they would probably be a little bit frustrated, but happy they've got virtually everyone fit to go out onto the pitch. And the last game, of course, is South Africa, the last quarterfinal, South Africa, Japan. And as you said, probably one of the most exciting out of all those, probably the most exciting as a non-English fan, you know, it'd be the...
That's why I picked it. That's why 3 months ago when I had selected my tickets, that was the one. I mapped it out to be Japan, South Africa. So I'm looking forward to it.
So whatever happens, we've got an incredible weekend of quarterfinal rugby ahead of us. And we'll look forward to coming back and discussing all those matches in detail and seeing if, as Leon believes, Ireland can beat New Zealand. I don't think anyone in the rugby playing world believes that is possible, apart from the man sat next to me over here. Anyway, that's it for our World Cup chat this week, mate. We're going to dive into a little head-to-head between me and you. But before we do that, let's have a little message from one of our sponsors.
Lewis, I'm not convinced that our listeners would appreciate the free offer we've got for them this week.
What? Because no one likes free beer, right?
Yeah, free beer.
This case, so this 8 beers, so this beautifully crafted beer comes from our mates at beer52.com. And if any of our listeners out there want to get hold of their own free case of beer, then all they need to do is go to www.beer52.com/moody. And cover just £4.95 for postage and package. I mean, who's not going to do that?
I like a freebie, but I also like free beer.
Mate, you should try one. So you've poured one into a glass there. That was the Grand Slam. The
Grand Slam, yep.
And we've also got with us a Ninkasi Blanche, so a nice white craft beer we're going to go with. Oh, the sound. Cheers.
Cheers.
Go on, Lloydie, whilst you're trying some of that, they're all different themes. So they come from, ranging from Germany to Korea, Norway, South Africa, California, Finland. But this company, these Beer 52 guys, they haven't forgotten their roots. So talking about roots, give me a little sample of those hops. How are they going down? The Grand Slam beer, very appropriate. Oh, I should have been drinking it, really. I mean, you never actually won a Grand Slam, did you?
The arrogance. That's really nice. Really, really refreshing. Really nice, actually.
So if you guys want to get hold of this, we'll let you know some information. Your first box will be sent to you next day and will contain beer from all over Europe, as we've mentioned. There'll be hoppy IPAs, there'll be hazy pale ales, there'll be refreshing lagers and more from breweries like Aura. From Italy, Ninkasi. From France, The Tempest. And from Scotland, Boss Brewing. What a name, Boss Brewing. If you're going to have any name for a company, it'd be The Boss, essentially, wouldn't it? From Wales and many more. But if you prefer some dark beers in there, then choose the mixed plan. It's quite easy, really. What's more, After the Whistle listeners get 2 extra free beers. So that's a total of 10 free beers just for listening to this podcast. I mean, you are lucky, lucky listeners out there. So if you want to get hold of your free case of beer, then just go to www.beer52.com/moody to get your first case of 8 beers for free. And don't forget, After the Whistle listeners get an extra 2 unmissable beers free. That's www.beer52.com/moody.
This is where this started from, really. Our car journey is stuck on the motorway.
Before
you know it, you've been chatting for 2 hours sometimes, and then at the end of it, I'll be at my destination.
Yeah.
Or you'll be sat on your drive still outside on your house, not gone into your house, because you just get deep and beneath the bonnet.
Yeah, well, it's one of those moments, isn't it? I suppose when you've got time on your hands, sat in a car, when you can actually, your brain
you're
starts.
You're not distracted. You're just driving. You're thinking, do you know what it'd be for me? I normally hear a song.
Yeah.
That's really weird. I'll hear a song on the radio and it would trigger me to a place from rugby, and it'll take me to a place and I think, oh man, then I'll call you.
Yeah.
And then all the things that I've been wanting, because obviously it's hard to get, everyone's busy.
Yeah.
So if I'm in a car, I'll try in. And obviously if you're not busy, you'll pick it up. And then it will lead me on to following on. I'll be able to get the 5-10 things that have been on my mind off my chest up to you, and vice versa. And I think that helps me, as I said, before I'd realize 2 hours have passed.
Yeah.
We've put the world to right.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's why we're here now. I suppose that's where it's born from.
The podcast sort of came from that, didn't it? Us discussing our...
But all sorts of, if you think about what we talked about, about family, kids, transition, rugby, are we on the right path? What is the right path? What does good look like? All those different things, or teammates, who needs help, who doesn't need help. All those things that we're talking about on the podcast is what we talk about just normally on those calls. So it's weird how we've just come full circle.
I know, but it's nice that it's ended up in this. And we've actually, so over the last five podcasts, we've discussed with numerous people, haven't we, including Steve Thompson's. You know, Tomo was the first podcast, and listening to his story and his challenges, where he come from, humble beginnings. You know, you had probably a similar beginnings in the dark days at Coventry. The dark days is probably a bit harsh, but it's probably because I look at Coventry as a complete hole of a place.
How dare you?
But
How dare you?
Obviously, without realizing, as a younger man, obviously the reason Coventry is like a 50s and 60s. Sort of monstrosity in my eyes is because of the bombing in the Second World War.
We have two cathedrals, and we are the European City of Culture next year, I think.
I love the fact that
I'm a Coventrian, I'm a very proud Coventrian.
So I know we'll obviously talk about lots of stuff in this, but just for my thought process in terms of you had a really interesting upbringing, you know, didn't necessarily know your biological dad, grew up in Coventry with some sort of nefarious, I'm going to say nefarious, I'm not entirely sure what that means, but I'm going to go with it, nefarious characters that maybe put you on a path that seemed right at the time. You know, what was that path? You know, what was that 14, 15, 16-year-old Leon Lloyd doing? Because I have the impression of someone that was possibly out nicking hubcaps and getting involved in drugs and all sorts of things.
Well, I think I feel very, very lucky to have, to have played rugby and the path of that has taken me on to where I am now today. But also, you know, it was tough, but I had a really good upbringing, and I had some amazing friends, you know, outside. Like, I think I had some great teammates, amazing teammates, but growing up in Coventry, I had some amazing, loyal friends, which, you know, sadly, because you go in different directions, I'm not in contact with lots of them, but I know some of them have reached back out to me on since the podcast and, you know, gave some feedback on it, which is great. But there's some of those guys, we started through rugby.
Yeah.
So I played football initially, then I started playing rugby with the school and through Bikers Boots.
But how did, but before we get onto that rugby stuff, and I know you want to, but I just want to know a little bit more about you, because we've not discussed this. I mean, we've always reflected on Cov being a pretty rough place and that you had a tough upbringing, but what was it like? You know, what were you up to as a 15, 16 year old?
I don't think it was just for me. I think just at that time, schools, I went to a pretty decent school, state school, County Court school, but there were lots of fights, inter-school fights going on and arranged fights and all
that. You were involved in those?
No, not me. that definitely wasn't for me.
Never liked fighting.
I didn't mind the odd scrap growing up, and that was because, you know, the environment I was in, that was you had to defend yourself and you had to look after yourself. And growing up in Coventry with those, that's why I feel very lucky to have those friends I had. We experienced some great things together. You know, some good, some bad, but just some great thing, all part of building your character as a person.
Yeah.
And as a school, it was just brilliant. In our year group, and it always comes back to sport for me, in our year group, we had someone who played for England schoolboys at football, someone who played for England schoolboys at cricket, and I played England schoolboys at rugby. So in a sort of a state school in Coventry, we had three young, and that's just three of us who were lucky enough to get selected. There were other people in that team that played with. So in a school where there were lots of distractions, be that scrapping, as I'm sure I thought that most schools scrapped anyway, but
what did a scrap look like to you? Because, you know, a scrap can be words or it can be
like fighting. That's proper scrapping, physical fighting. That happened quite a lot, but again, it was just part and parcel. Just part and parcel of growing. I thought that was the norm, and not until I met you and saw you with your silver spoon that I realized that wasn't the norm. But I wouldn't change any of it. I genuinely wouldn't change any of it. It was a great school. I had some great friends. I learned a lot about myself. I learned how to stick up for myself, defend myself, but stick up for my friends. I learned about loyalty, which again, I think that stood me in good stead for going to the Tigers. When I needed discipline. I definitely needed some discipline in my life. Not that it didn't come from my parents, because my dad was quite strict.
Yeah.
But I needed that.
So let's talk about that sort of family connection. So mum, dad, it was a council estate, brought up on a council estate.
Yeah. High rise flat in the centre of Coventry, born, and then moved out to a council house in Radford. And then I went to a school. I've got one brother and two sisters. Yeah, it was good. It was tough, just as it would be growing up in the sort of the early 80s.
And how was it? And I hope I put this right, and you don't think this is derogatory, but how was it as a black man growing up in Coventry at that time, which, you know, in that area culturally as well, I presume you were probably one of a few.
No, well, it was tough because in my family, you know, I'm the only black person in my family.
Yeah.
So that was quite, it wasn't difficult because there's lots of racism was normal.
Yeah.
But up there. So I was just used to it and I just got on with it. And I suppose that's what led to me being more forthcoming with my fighting, really, I suppose, because it happened all the time.
Yeah. Did you feel you had to fight your corner more?
I did. And also for my brother, which he's probably not even aware of it, but he would have got grief as well for having, you know, me being his brother and stuff like that. So I think I was just, again, it's just one of those things I've never really looked back on, but it certainly shaped how I was and how I viewed people and how I viewed life.
When you think about that, do you find it emotionally quite difficult? Because I'm looking at you now, like your eyes are slightly watery, which
is... They're not.
I've just yawned. I've just yawned.
Got
something in my eye. Do you find that hard to sit back and reflect on? And actually those times were difficult.
It was tough. It was genuinely tough. But it's no tougher than anybody else. Now, we've all had tough times. I've not had any tougher than anybody else. But for me to go through that, it was tough. I wouldn't change any of it because it makes me who I am today and it helps who I am as a person, as a friend, as a dad. You know, that's just who I am. So I wouldn't change any of it, but I'm not going to lie and say it wasn't tough.
And what was the hardest thing that you had to deal with during those times coming through school? And
I'm not academic, but I work hard. I've never let effort get in the way of something. And I shared that with my rugby. I was never the best player, but if it come down to effort and training and everything else, I was never going to be caught short on that front. So I just worked hard no matter what it was, whether it be schoolwork, whether it be sport in any, I played all sports.
Yeah.
Got kicked out of school a lot for fighting, as you've probably been not surprised to know.
So when you say kicked out of school, like moved to school?
I got suspended from school, so out for little things. But thankfully, because I was half decent at rugby, they kept letting me back in to play for the team. But again, at the time, I look back at it now and I think, God, at the time it was just normal. It was like, I knew what was going to happen if I got into trouble, but I still did it because I knew, you know, that was just part and parcel of going through. I left home at 16, similar to Tomo. Because I needed to...
Steve Thompson, who we spoke about in our podcast. Yeah.
So I needed to put myself in a different environment if I was going to do something different.
Mm.
Nothing changes if nothing changes.
So did you make that choice or did you have support to help you make that choice?
I left home on my own decision.
At 16?
At 16.
Yeah.
I went to live with
them. And how was your mum and dad about that?
It was the right time. You know, we lived in a small house,
relatively
small house. So there was four of us, four kids. Mum worked really hard, dad worked really hard, and I probably had a chip on my shoulder.
Mm.
And it just made it easier if I sort of just left.
What was that chip? That chip was, I'm better than this, or?
No, not better than this.
I don't fit in, or?
No, I think it was just I don't know, I just felt like I was just pushing myself to achieve.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I wanted to achieve, I just wanted to do things and try lots of different things. And it just, you know, like as a kid, a 16-year-old kid, always at loggerheads anyway with your parents. So. Yeah. I left at 16 to live with Andy McCannum, who was played on the wing for the Tigers. And it was not long after that I got moved out of Coventry to live in Leicester, to live with Martin Johnson. Because Pete Lloyd, if you remember Pete Lloyd.
Yeah.
He saw something in me, which...
So Pete Lloyd was, what, a 70-year-old fan of rugby?
Yeah, Barker Butts,
which is where you, Danny Grucock, Neil Back... Anyone else?
Tom Wood, Jim Hamilton.
So
some of the boys came through there, and and sadly his wife had passed away not long before then. So I didn't know him or her at the time. But his passion was rugby, so he threw his whole life into rugby. And he used to drive Backy over from.
Did he? So,
yeah,
so
early days.
Responsible for you and Neil Back's introduction.
Yeah, definitely Jim and Andy McAdam as well. that's the link, really. That's the glue that binds us all together. And he took me over to Leicester. I played England schoolboys against Wales at Twickenham, and Tony Russ sort of got signed. He probably didn't want to sign me, but Lloydy forced him to sign me. And he also, Lloydy spoke to Martin Johnson about getting me to live with him. He felt like I needed to take me out of the environment I was in, because the people I was knocking around with. And Jono reluctantly probably agreed for me to live with him, and I did. And I suppose for me that was...
Did you ever met him before at the time? So Martin Johnson, so obviously it was at 96, hadn't done the Lions tour.
I met him at training. So I was at training. I was in the youth team.
Yeah.
As I trained, and I'd seen him, and I think I trained with the senior squad a little bit.
Through the youth team.
Through the youth team, yeah. So I trained, just been brought in for bag holding sessions and get my head kicked in, that, those type
the
of sessions.
The cannon fodder, yeah, where we used to get wheeled out days. For. Well, so, actually, back then, so the youth teams, which would have been like the under-18s, and then you'd have the, was it the under-21s and the Colts and the under-21s, yeah, and the development. So those boys, once a year, used to have a run out against the first team, didn't, yeah, we? It was mental. Imagine being a first team player now and having a load of Keno
18, if I injure you, I'm going to get your shirt, because, yeah, that's what we did.
Yeah, I mean, it was just a brawl, yeah, essentially.
They were brutal days. So I've known him, obviously knew who he was. He didn't know who I was, and why would he? But I remember, because I got into a few scraps at training early on in those days. I know I had a big fight with Austin Healey.
Talk to me about that. So obviously Austin's one of those characters that people love or hate. He's quite gobby. He's happy to say what, you know, what he feels, especially when he first came into the squad. What was he, 2, 3, 4 years older than you?
Yeah, he was 5 years older than me, I think. So, okay. But he'd signed down from Oral. I think that year we signed Austin, Will Greenwood, and Craig Joyner, 3 big signings.
How did the fight come around?
It looks stupid now going back on it. It was. It's literally about a burger in, yeah, a nightclub in the VIP area. Yeah, so it's a bit
over a burger.
It's a bit embarrassing what we're talking about. It was
bacon.
A cheeseburger with, right, gherkins, nice, and bacon, everything in it.
Yeah,
And I remember I was sat.
And we're in Leicester, obviously.
We were in Leicester,
point,
in the nightclub, yeah, and I was this young, I was this kid sat looking around at all these people who were senior to me, a lot senior to me. I was really young.
Yeah.
And like you hadn't come on the scene then, so yeah. I was literally the only. The next youngest person to me would have probably been Austin, who was like 4 or 5 years older. So I sat there thinking, I feel lucky to be here, but what am I doing here? And I sat there dressed as Dracula because it was a fancy dress costume. And Austin just, and Austin was proper Norse back then. Mm-hmm. Some may say still is, but yeah. I get on with Austin. And I remember he came over to me and just grabbed my burger out of my hand. And I tell you, I'm a different person now, but as I've alluded to earlier on, I had a bit of a thing on my shoulder
red
back
mist.
Then where there was all about respect. Yeah. So I will show you respect. Don't disrespect me. And I felt that was disrespect.
Yeah.
So I reacted.
Did he actually eat the burger?
He took a bite out of the burger.
Did he? That is so disrespectful.
It's so rude.
Oh my God. What was he thinking?
I don't think he got to finish it.
What happened then? So tell me.
I can't remember. We had a little scuffle.
Yeah, and he fell on the floor.
And then everything was, that was great because all of a sudden, those guys who I was with knew who I was, even though I was sort of playing with them and training with them.
Yeah.
They sort of knew I had a line and that I'm very respectful. I don't think you'll find anyone who says I'm not respectful. So yeah. They knew where my line was. And that sort of put me on the map with the senior guys and also impacted my friendship with Austin because from then we became really good mates. Not straight away, obviously.
Yeah.
But after that, we became really good mates, roomed together for 10 years. And we speak to each other now. So I think that sort of set my rugby path at Leicester. Scrap.
Yeah. But those, you can understand why, because that's a side full of the likes of Dean Richards, Darren Garforth, Graham Rowntree, Neil Back, Martin Johnson. I'm trying to remember the name, John Wells. More like proper old school.
Also, even then, it was like John Lyley, those days, John Lyley, Dowell Cardoony. You're right, the hard guys, the forwards were just.
Rory Underwood.
Relentlessly, the hard guys. they're relentlessly fierce and tough individuals.
Yeah.
And I knocked around with, because my introduction was through Backy, coming from Barkers, and then through Martin Johnson, I knocked around with the forwards more than I did the backs. So it was weird because I was knocking around with all those horrible Leicester forwards as opposed to the backs, really.
So what was it like? So obviously coming from that Cov state school upbringing, you know, having to fight your corner to be recognised and seen in the world and feel like you were, you know, I don't know, putting words in your mouth, sort of standing up for yourself, actually making a name for yourself maybe by doing all those things. What was it like when you suddenly came to Leicester and you met people like me, same age, that had been through private school, public school? And obviously we have to mention, so I went to Oakham School, fantastic school. I've seen Alex Goode and Stuart Broad and various people come through. But what was your take on private school boys at that point?
So we'd have played against King Henry VIII, which would be the private school then. And that was our big fixture of the year because we played against this privileged group. And that was always our biggest one for us to go and just try and keep their heads in. So going to a Leicester, I remember we played it, we sort of trialled against each other, if you remember, you probably don't remember. You came to Leicester as a centre.
I do remember.
We trialled against each other, but I didn't know you as anything else. I was just like a fish out of water. I'd gone to Leicester, someone had given me an opportunity. So it was, for me, it was me or them. That was my approach to it. And it wasn't until sort of you came back as a, you sort of a famous Leicester coach converted you from centre to a back row player.
Yeah.
And then you came back as a back row player. So we were no longer in competition, because if we were in competition, we wouldn't have been friends. Yeah. That was my mindset.
I remember that first session. Someone had a picture of it. Someone showed us a picture of it.
Lloyd, probably. Yeah, I know you took photographs of all those sessions.
But that was awesome. So I started out as a centre literally at 17 in my first engagement. I remember seeing you and our now close mate, Mitch Reed, who finished his career quite early after that. But I remember thinking, right, I'm going to properly flatten these two boys. And I think Mitch was the first, I got the first tackle in on Mitch, and not only did I not flatten him, he actually flattened me. I ended up on the floor.
Don't tell him that.
I won't.
That'd be the first time we've ever done that to anybody.
It was a rude awakening. But then you went back
to Oakham. Well, I didn't know it was Oakham then, but you went back, and then you came back so Dossa Smith converted you then, I think, to a back row player.
That's right, yeah.
And then you, next thing we know, you came back and played England 18s a year early. And then that was your path going that way. So then when you're no longer in competition to me, then we could be friends.
Yeah.
that's how I viewed life back then, either with me or against me.
So when I was at school at Oakham, it was Brian Welford and Andy Wolstenholme, and then Dossa Smith that sort of moved me. And I ended up playing back row and loved it. It was like the reason I ended up having a successful career in 71 caps and what have you, which was...
Didn't you win a cup as well? Didn't you win
a couple of successful things.
Didn't you win a World Cup? How long has it been? It's been like 16 minutes. You're like 60 minutes. You're not said anything.
Oh, mate. Yeah, but those moments, mentors, they're the sorts of people that you need, aren't they? Did you ever have coming through, did you have a mentor other than Pete Lloyd, or was there someone else?
So for me, who was really instrumental, and I don't know if he knows it or not, but Neil Back, I put him on a pedestal because he needs it, because he's quite short, so he needs to go on a pedestal so he can match me in height.
He needs to be on a pedestal.
But his attitude to everything, not just rugby, but to everything, was something I'd never seen before. And he was like, I remember he got banned around that time. I think he got banned early 90s. I can't remember when he got banned for pushing the referee, allegedly pushing over Steve Lander. So it really coincided with me coming over to Leicester. And I watched him train his body shape and everything else. Just his approach to professionalism was just unbelievable. And I thought, God, if that's what it takes, I had nothing to compare him to. If that's what it takes to be a rugby player, could I do that? That's a challenge. And then obviously live with Jono, another person, you know, you think of elite athletes who went on to achieve what they both achieved. So I was surrounded by, I was with those two, then Graham Rowntree came into the fold. So I was training with those guys. It was just a different level. Mm. I always looked to, if I'm struggling, I always look to what would back it, in my go-to would be, what would Backy do? If stuff gets hard on the training field, or if I'm in the weights room or I'm doing fitness stuff and I'm thinking, I can't go anymore, I've got two more reps, I can't do it anymore. Genuinely, in my mindset goes, what would Backy do in this? And that's because I've been at that 16, you know, that age where you're sort of...
impressionable.
Yeah. And I'd always think, well, there's no way he would stop. And that's what got me through so many bleep tests, so many sort of trials and everything else. Just because I'd always think, what would Backy do in this situation?
I remember being put in a room with Neil Back in like my first tour, it might be second tour, because the coaches wanted me to be like Neil Back. Yeah. So you need to pick up on Neil Back's strength. So literally, I remember being
mean? When they say be like, what parts? Not the way he played rugby, but his mentality. What do you mean?
Well, his approach to the game, which is always about, as you mentioned, sort of getting the best out of his body. So it was a total focus, you know, because he was tiny in back row terms. Compared to the guys that were around England at the time, like the Winterbottoms, the Ben Clarks, the Rodbers, you know, massive, massive lads that were playing. So his approach was, how can I get the best out of me? Be the fittest, focus on his food. You know, he was militant, wasn't he?
Weighing his food
and all that sort of jam. I mean, I couldn't have been further away from that sort of obsessive OCD type mentality.
But you were at the other end. I remember you were at the other end, because my first introduction to you really was when you made your debut for Leicester, you came in. And you were going out. I think you were at uni, and you and Geordie, and Geordie at uni together or something. So bearing in mind, I'd come into this regime with all the older players who are measuring their food and measuring their sleep patterns and everything else. Then I'm seeing you guys come through, and you're out literally on the smash.
We were Wednesday midweek, night student
night midweek on a Wednesday, and it used to really genuinely used to annoy me because I couldn't get my head around it. So I'd be under this regime of getting my head down, getting my hours in kit wise, doing my weights recovery, and I'd watch you guys coming after a Wednesday night on the smash, hearing about all these stories that you were getting up to, and I wasn't getting up to them. And then you'd go out and play on a Saturday, and if it wasn't you winning man of the match, it'd be Geordie winning man of the match. And I just couldn't, literally back then, I couldn't understand how you managed to do it. And I even tried, I came out with you to try and I remember I came out a few nights to try and see if I could do it, and I'd go out and get on the smash, and then that was me written off. Like I literally, I could not back up a training session, but you boys did it differently to how the likes of Jono and Becky and those boys.
Well, I think that's the sort of point I wanted to get to. Like, you know, the coaches put me in a room with Neil Back saying, right, we want you to pick up on some of his, you know, we want you to be like Backy, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, one of the best things that ever happened to me was that the club signed Josh Kronfeld, arguably the two best open sides in the world in the mid to late 1990s. And I was like, right, okay, well, I'm not going to get a game, but I probably can learn off these two guys. So if I can do that, it's gonna help me. And actually what I learned was you just got to be yourself, because yeah. I spent 2 years trying to be like Neil Back, folding my clothes meticulously, you know.
Getting out your little tie socks out.
Yeah. You know, he used to have those ties around the top of his socks that had the little, you know, cuts
in.
Yeah,
he's got OCD.
Yeah. And that's just not, I'm the polar opposite. Like you said, you know, I needed to do what worked for me. Me and Jordan Murphy, now, you know, Tigers head coach, we used to go out on a Wednesday midweek and relax, it'd be, because Thursday'd be the day
off. And a Monday and Tuesday probably as well.
No, not Monday. I mean, when I look back at those early days, I just think, what was I thinking? You know, you're right, like the perception of us by the senior players must have been an absolute joke. And, you know, to be fair, probably it was only in 98 when I went on my first England tour with Clive. And I tried to be really disciplined and focused, and then realised on the first night out that the boys, we came in early, you know, thought do the right thing. Actually, none of the lads had come in. We're like, oh, do we need to be out with the team? You know, actually making more of an effort. And then we ended up coming at like 4 a.m. and it was like it went all completely downhill from then. I didn't play again for 3 years for England. But that moment made me realise, okay, if I want to be a professional, I need to seriously change my
You got the balance
mindset.
Right though, didn't you? Because like, I think I was I was at one extreme of punishing myself and not drinking everything else. Where you were, I remember watching, you lived in a house, was you Paul Gustard, Geordie, Jimmy Ferris, and I used to watch you boys go out, and I never used to come out with you ever.
Yeah.
And you used to go out and you were living the dream, living the life, and you still put the performances in. So if you're looking back at it now, you may say you could have changed it or reined it in a little bit, but you seem to, from me, from my perspective, you look like you got the balance right. And you look at your CV now, and look at yours and Geordie's CV, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, true. There's always things you look and reflect on, isn't there? You could do differently. But yeah, we certainly, it was important for me, that realisation that actually I'm not Neil Back, I'm not Josh Kronfeld, I'm Lewis Moody. And there are elements I can take out of each of these guys, that Josh was super laid back, like horizontal, wasn't he? And Backy was, you know, totally focused, militant. And they both got the best out of the bodies. And I probably sat somewhere in between the two of them, playing style, temperament and everything.
Yeah, because you were quite uptight. I remember you were quite an uptight person.
Oh, please.
And tight as well.
Both. Yeah, very, very tight.
I remember playing a game where we had the back row was picked as you, Backy and Josh. Do you remember that game?
Yeah, we played one game.
And I'm thinking to myself, what an amazing back row.
Yeah.
It didn't work because all three of you were literally racing each other to get to the ball.
Yeah, it's like a competition.
Three sevens on the pitch.
I'm the best.
But to have that, I remember that. Whether you're a supporter of the Red Devils, Blues, Citizens, Hammers or Gunners, the easiest place to watch all English Premier League action this season is with ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN allows you to access all EPL streams from around the world for a fraction of the price it would normally cost.
So for less than £6 per month, you can get access to the fastest VPN around. And all your network data will be encrypted, secure and safe from hackers, which is brilliant for us, obviously, as we travel a lot.
Very true. But it's not just the cash in your wallet that you need to keep safe.
Mate, so with ExpressVPN, it also allows you to spoof your location.
That means if you were in a different country, for example, you could say that you were there and it would enable you to watch the sport that is in that country.
Very handy indeed.
It's very handy. So use ExpressVPN to buy an 11 sports account. It costs less than £6 per month and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee.
Nice, mate. And you can enjoy all the fun the English Premier League has to offer with the world's most trusted VPN, ExpressVPN. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/moody. That's expressvpn.com/moody. For 3 months free with a 1-year package, visit expressvpn.com/moody to learn more. So we had some awesome times. Let's talk about, so we played England as well. So I had the great pleasure of playing with you in an England jersey on my first England tour in 2001. But you had, you came onto a South Africa tour, didn't you? How did that tour go? Do you remember those first moments when you first got capped?
I do, yeah, I do. Because I remember I was on the fringe for a little while. Again, Leicester were doing well, and I was sort of, if you're doing well for your club and you're top of the league, then you're going to get there or thereabouts. I was with these senior players, so I was sort of in and out the training squads for a while. 99 Cup squad, was involved in that, didn't get picked. Then I got my chance to go on tour to South Africa in 2000 after we'd just had another successful year for Leicester. And I remember I went out there as midweek. I think I was fifth choice centre. Yeah. And then I played in the midweek game for a few injuries. Ended up having a half decent game in that. And I got put on the bench for the first test against South Africa in Pretoria, Loftus first foul. And again, I was looking around the side thinking, Jesus, this is a big test.
Yeah.
And what made it even harder was the fact that Johnny Wilkinson had a sickness bug the night before the game.
So it wasn't playing.
So he pulled out the morning of the game. So the team had to be shuffled around and Austin stepped up to play fly half, having never played fly half for England before. So he stepped up and played fly half. And I remember on the bench and the centres were Tindall and Mike Catt. So yeah, it's Mike Tindall and Mike Catt. And it's one of those games, as you know, playing against South Africa, altitude, very fierce, full on. And I played in big Heineken Cup games before that point, and I didn't think, well, what could the level up be? Because I heard players say, this is like Test rugby, this match is like Test rugby, there's no difference. But I can only say, when I ran on that pitch and got my first tackle, or got tackled, it wasn't like, the stuff I'd played before wasn't like playing it against South Africa, away at Loftus-Versfeld. But I remember I was on the pitch for a minute or 2 minutes maybe. And I ran on. I was lucky because when I ran on, there's probably like 8, 9, 10 players on that team who were Leicester teammates.
Yeah.
So it was like playing for Leicester. So I ran on and most of the boys were there. And Jono said, congratulations.
He said that when he came on.
He said, get your head on. I remember saying, get your head on, get your hands on the ball, get stuck in. And I thought I had to get my hand on the ball really quickly. So I got my hands on the ball really quickly, ran into a rook, got absolutely melted. Like I got smashed down the ground and I got kicked in the face. And I remember like the blood came through my mouth. I could taste straight away, instantly I could taste it.
Yeah.
And I'd just come on the pitch and my head was all over the place. I don't know if you remember your debut or not, but I've just come off the bench.
No, I don't remember it.
So coming off, so just
for those
the bench,
reasons.
Yeah. Come off the bench and I was like, head's all over the place, thinking this thing that I dreamed of doing has just happened.
Yeah.
How do I make an impact? And I was on there and I got kicked in the face and I just reacted. And let's go back to what we talked about before.
Yeah.
I reacted to how anyone from commentary would react to being kicked in the face. And I remember just sending the commentary hammer through and connecting with a Springbok player, Devette Barry it was, who was a very clean South African player. And I caught him and I carried on running because I just thought it just part and parts of the game. I got kicked in the face, I punch you in the face back, quits, carry on. And the referee blew a loud blow of the whistle. And as I get up and I can taste blood and I've got a hole in my chin and I'm looking around thinking, great, we've got the penalty. And I look up in the screen in the corner of the pitch and I see in slow motion a savaged English rugby player, which was me, with blood and things spit flying out of his mouth in slow motion, punching a defenceless South African who's lying on his back in slow-mo. And they kept showing it from different angles. And I'm thinking, well, rewind that a little bit first and you'll see what happened. And obviously they didn't do that. And the ref, I thought I was going to get sent off. I was walking over to him, he called me over. And I genuinely, I've been on the pitch for maybe a minute, 2 minutes. And I thought, oh my God, I'm actually going off. I'm actually being sent off. And I'd have done anything at that point not to get sent off. And I got called over with the captain. And I think he realised I'd just come on the pitch and he sort of reached for his pocket and pulled out a dummy hand. And I'm thinking, oh God, he said number 22, any more of that and you're going off.
Yeah.
I was so relieved. Like,
didn't even get a yellow card?
Didn't get a yellow card.
That's brilliant. Yeah. So I did exactly the same and got red carded. I mean, that is classic. Well,
you've got to go somewhere to get red carded by England.
So how do you, I don't want to dwell on that too much. Obviously that was a frustrating moment in your career. You then went on to have five more caps. But you know, maybe the relationship with Clive wasn't...
Oh, I was tarred. I was pigeonholed then of discipline, poor discipline. Yeah. So that was just one of those things, you know, you can't change it. It happened.
But one of my fondest memories of is you telling me after, you know, having been out, having played in that test match, you'd been out for a while, you'd gone on that America tour, you'd been playing really well, you know, you'd changed your perception, your mindset around dealing with penalties and red mist, and you'd tempered everything, you'd got it under control, and you went into a training session and you had a fantastic bit of play, broke through, scored under the post, and you saw Clive walking towards you on the way back, and Clive had a tendency for high-fiving everyone back then, didn't he? And you were thinking, happy days, this is my moment. Clive will appreciate, you know, where I've come from, where I'm at now. And as you walked back and as Clive was walking towards you, you went for the big high five, didn't you?
That's
and
not exactly. That's
and
not
totally
exactly.
Blanked you.
It was that's not exactly how it happened, but the outcome was still the same. I remember, you're right, I went through. And my thing for me, because I give away that penalty in that match and it is history now.
Yeah.
Clive still picked me after that, which was obviously really grateful for, and still picked me some more caps. But in my mind, I'd always felt like I had to try and change his perception of me.
Yeah.
So I remember going through the middle on the training field and ghosted through, scored a try. And as I ran back, what I thought, and to this day, I still think it was, he put his hand out to do a high five because he was famous for a bit of the high five. And I thought, I've got a high five. So as I put my hand out to high five him as I run past, I realized when it was too late, he was actually pointing to Dave Aldred, who was on the other side of the field. So he had a pointed hand putting across, and I've gone up and going, woo, tried to high-five
high
him.
Five,
and then as
five.
I put my hand up there, he moved his hand around, down. And I tried to do the old, scratch my head, make out that, see if anyone noticed it. And guess who noticed it? Everyone.
Oh, so
it was,
good.
It was brutal.
I wish that had been videoed. I really wish that had been videoed. And you had another moment as well. Your first involvement with England was your meeting at the Petersham Hotel. So literally your first ever meeting. And Clive had a massive thing for about not being late.
Lombardi
and all that.
Time.
Yeah, Lombardi time, be 10 minutes early. And one of the boys, I think the boys had told you, well, you tell the story what happened first meeting.
I was rooming with Neil McCarthy at the Petersham Hotel, and it's my first one. Like, there, I've got all the kit, and it's really, really special. And I knew about the meeting, so all I got told was, don't be late. So for me, if the meeting's at 2 o'clock, if I get there at 1 minute to two, I'm not late in my mind.
Yeah,
that's not Lombardi time, which I was unaware of, which is if you're 5 minutes early, you're 5 minutes late or whatever that was. So I turn up to the meeting. I'm looking around. I walk out my room looking for all the lads, and no one's around. You know when you get that horrible feeling that you're late for something? And I'm looking at my watch thinking, no, I'm not late. And I run around, I can't find the room that I'm meeting in. Anyway, I get to the room, everyone is sat down and Clive's talking, and there wasn't even a chair. There wasn't even a chair there, so I had to sit on the floor at the foot of the meeting room. And in my panic that I was there late already, I'm there, I'm sweating already, and I'm thinking, and I can see all that Jono and them shaking their heads as they're walking. I'm thinking, oh my God, this is the last meeting, first and last meeting I'm ever going. I forget to switch my phone off. So I'm sat down, and you know as well what Woody was like. So
that's like a cardinal sin.
What, being late or the phone?
Both. First being late, and then something distracting him.
Almost certainly one of the boys had called me. Anyway, yeah. So as soon as I sit down, my phone starts ringing in my pocket after about a minute, and I feel it's mine. I'm thinking, can anybody else hear that? And I'm trying to push the phone into my thigh, trying to like numb the noise, like the noise down. And I'm pushing it so hard in, I'm joking, I'm bruising my leg. And the meeting just stops. And everyone's looking around. I look around as well and see, oh, whose phone is that? Who's not switched it off? And I tried to switch the phone off in my pocket.
But didn't work.
Didn't get away with that one either.
I love those stories because I know you so well. I know how much that would have upset you. And like you are now.
I've left it. I'm not carrying it with me at all.
It's gone. Just parked it. It's on the way behind. It's Humphrey Waters with the said ones. But look, so you had a stellar career with Leicester. So you played over 250 games, 240 games, something like that. You had 5 Premiership titles, 2 Heineken Cups. You scored 2 tries in the Heineken Cup, Leicester's first win of the Heineken Cup final back in 2000. You had all those monumental moments, and you came through as a schoolboy playing in the schoolboy system, the academy, the Colts, the 21s, everything like that. So you were a Leicester man through and through. I want to talk, but you know, before we finish, just about how hard you found it leaving that club or being forced out of that club, the club that you saw. You know, you talked about loyalty being so key to you at the start, and at Leicester, it's drilled into you as a player, loyal to the club. You know, that's with you the whole time. You'll always be loyal to the players, to the club. How did you find out when that club that you'd sacrificed and given so much loyalty to then didn't necessarily repay it?
Yeah, that was tough. That's probably one of the toughest times I've had. And I suppose that's what's driven me to doing what I'm doing now in my day job, you know, switch to play, and why we're talking about, you know, the mental health, the transition, all those things, because it was really tough. Because I did, no difference to anybody else, I was loyal to that club, like everybody else was. And then you don't realise that you are just a small part of a big machine, and it's a job. And at some point your time will come up. So my time came up, my time to join that club was when Roy Underwood moved out and I stepped in. Then you think you're going to go on there forever. And I remember, being told that my contract wasn't going to be renewed, but I was fine with that because I already had another year left on my contract anyway.
Yeah.
But then not only was it not being renewed, but they didn't actually want me to take up that extra year.
Yeah.
That's actually for someone. And also I'd been there for so long, my body was broken, like genuinely broken. And I felt like I'd done all that for no reason.
Yeah.
And at the time, I look back on it now and I'm so glad it happened. It makes me see relationships differently. And I don't put all my trust into, you know, you have to look after yourself. But at the time it was tough. Like it was really, really tough.
So I remember you talking about sitting in the house when Dean was coming round, and you were like hiding in the front room. So Dean Richards, the coach, was coming round and trying to get hold of you and all those sorts of things. Was that the same time?
Yeah, no, that was a different time. So I only ever really thought about leaving Leicester once. And that was the year before. That was in 2001 after we won this Hunting Cup for the second time. And I contemplated signing for Harlequins. I'd gone quite a long way down the route of talked to those guys, and you're right, Dino was trying to changed my mind. It wouldn't have taken a lot, and it didn't take a lot because I just needed to feel like I was part of the squad that I had to put. I need to fulfill something. There's no point in being there. I don't want to be a spare part. I need to contribute to the team. And he reassured me that I was part of that team, and I thankfully went on and proved that right. But when it actually came around, that wasn't my choice. That was just, I wasn't looking to leave. That sort of blindsided me.
And that was because actually, so Pat Howard, who you played with, wonderful player who I respected massively, you know, played for Australia, came over, played with us, you respected massively. You had a falling out with him, essentially, which, am I right in saying that cost, you know, he then came back. So after we finished playing, he then came back as a coach. And for whatever reason, you fell out with Pat at that point.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into, the details of that. But yeah, we had Pat was my, you talk about mentor, I say backy, as a player. I played in the centre with Paddy Howard and I scored a shedload of tries.
Yeah.
Not because I was good at scoring tries, it's because I ran outside Paddy Howard and he created so much space and so many opportunities for me. I just ran off his shoulder and I scored tries. And my getting picked for England, I put down largely to playing in a great back line, but also having a good relationship with Pat on the playing field. So we got on really well and I'd go to him for advice and everything else. And our relationship changed somewhat when he became the boss and we had a fallout. But again, I'm not going to dwell on it because I'm so glad it happened.
Yeah.
Because now I see things differently. And at some point you go through, like, you have ups and downs. I call it the sweet and sour, you know, to fully appreciate the sweet, you have to taste the sour. And I tasted the sour then, so hopefully that won't happen to me again in the future. But yeah, it's just one of those things. I've moved on through. I keep saying that.
Yeah, it's easy to say, isn't it? Because that's, I know. And we've been talking for ages now. I mean, we could literally go on for hours. And it's the same with every guest because there's so much you want to sort of delve into, but it's impossible to cover everything. But those dark days are so important to talk about, aren't they? Because they're what sort of form us and drive us and form our opinions.
Yeah, but at the time, you can't see the light at the end of it.
Yeah.
I remember running out.
What was the darkest day for you during that time then? So you ended up leaving Leicester, you went to Gloucester, and it was dark times. We'd played together for 15 years.
The dark time was when I sat at the club because I was there. We were in to do a treble that year and we were in the final, three finals, the Anglo-Welsh, the Premiership and the Hinding Cup final. And I think I was the only player out of the whole squad, the senior squad. Bear in mind, I'd won 11 trophies to that point already. So I'd been involved in every major campaign we'd had. I think I was the only player not to feature in one of those finals. And then when the boys were on you lot were on the pitch holding up the trophies and everything else, and I was sat in my number ones there, knowing that I was leaving the club and also knowing that I wasn't talking about it to anybody else as well, because it would come across as sour grapes, because I'd come out and train with the second team and you boys were
training. That was 2007.
Yeah.
I remember that moment. You said you're not speaking to anyone else. I knew you were going through a tough time at that point. And I think all of us, well, certainly me in particular, wanted to get you down onto the pitch.
I remember, yeah.
And we'd actually won the two finals prior to the Heineken Cup final. So we'd won the league and the cup. And then we hadn't gone out because we wanted to celebrate the third and be the first team winning the treble. And it didn't happen. We lost to Wasps. We were well convincingly beaten by Wasps and Lawrence Delaney's side. But I remember, you know, desperate trying to get you down onto the pitch because it was your last game. But I actually remember being in an emotional floods of tears game. Do you remember that?
I remember, we were
sat down in the room afterwards. I think it's the first time, you know, genuinely ever sort of just openly sobbed and cried.
Yeah, me too. I remember you started crying and I was like, don't cry. So I started crying. I had to go and get, I was presented with a tankard for service to Leicester, and you started crying before I went up there, and I was like, oh my God, hold it together.
Yeah.
That was tough. Like, they're tough days. Yeah. But as I say, I'm glad it happened then, because otherwise I was more prepared when I went to Gloucester, and I was more prepared when my career ended, because I'd already been through a really tough time. And everyone who leaves a club goes through a tough time if it's not on your choice. So, yeah, it's just...
This is a realisation of actually how much you enjoyed playing together, actually how much you enjoyed it's the loyalty to the club is irrelevant. The loyalty to your teammates.
The boys, the players. Exactly.
That's all it's about.
That's the recipe, secret recipe.
Yeah. We could go on for ages, mate, but I just want to finish. So now, you know, you had a wonderful career at Leicester. You had 5 caps for England. Just give me a quick understanding of what you're doing now. So what the transition's been for you.
Yeah, so as I say, it was tough. I went to Gloucester. It was great. Really good time. Really good club to go to. Just, I was in the wrong frame of mind. It was just for me where I was going. And then my career ended, unfortunately, after, you know, 5 games. I think I played 5 games down there, and we sort of the birth of our daughter. So I retired, moved back to Leicester, went through a dark spot. It was you that helped me get out of that spot. So thanks.
You're welcome.
Getting me a job at Oakham School.
It's a standard. I'm always there for you, mate. I'm always there for you.
So now I work at, so fast forward a few years, I've done lots of different things, which has been great. I purposely chose not to go into sport because I think I was still hurting from the sport itself. So I sort of turned my back on the sport completely.
I still feel that you've turned your back on rugby. I think you've parked it. You've tried to get.
I've drawn a line and do it. Yeah, as we talked about in earlier episodes about World Cup moments, and I think I'm chasing my World Cup moment. I don't know if that would be in rugby now, but I have. I sort of.
Would you like to go back into the game? Like, could you ever see yourself taking over as CEO or chairman at the Leicester Tigers? Maybe.
I wouldn't say Leicester Tigers. I wouldn't put a club on it. I think what I've learned from my experience is it's a job.
Mm.
So would it be Gloucester? Could it be Bath? Could it be anywhere else? I wouldn't necessarily say it would be Leicester Tigers. I think I'm very grateful for what the sport has given me. So that's rugby in general. Had an amazing time at Leicester Tigers. If I feel, I talked about before, I need to feel like I'm fulfilling something. I need to be adding value. If I can add value to some place, then yes, I would say it. So I'd never say never, but I have no burning desire to go and be the chief executive of Leicester Tigers. Mm. But I love rugby, and will I get involved with it later down the line? I think I will. But where that is, it's not on my priority list.
Well, the good news for all of us is that you are doing brilliant work with Switch the Play and transitioning and helping athletes of all sports transition, including your former playmates. But just before we wrap it up, what would be the best piece of advice you've ever had or given? Received the best piece of advice you've ever received, and what would you give to former a younger Leon Lloyd?
I'm massive on feedback. I try and seek feedback from everybody. So I've had lots of advice from, and I'm quite lucky because through sport, I get to speak to lots of successful people, athletes, businessmen, you know, people from all over. So it's tough to figure out, to nail on one piece of advice. But I'd definitely say the best piece of advice I give to athletes now, especially at Switch to Play, we specialize in transition, is to not just focus on your sport, like what I did, focus on you as an individual. You're more than just your job. I got that advice after I'd finished playing. You are more than just your job. Whereas me, when I was playing, I was a rugby player. Not I was Leon who played rugby, and I was a dad, and I was a husband, and everything else. I was just a rugby player in my mind. Now I'd say to people, you are more than that. That's great, and that's a big part of you, but you are more than that. That's, I suppose that's the bit I try and push to people, is understand where you are and provide perspective in their lives.
Mate, it's been awesome chatting to you today. I can see over the course of it's been nearly an hour, so it's been longer than we ever anticipated. But you've had misty eyes during most of that, so it's been some tough.
That's a lie.
Some tough topics. His mates in Coventry will be, hopefully they're emotionally mature enough now to understand that it's okay to show your emotions and your feelings. But I've loved discussing this, and it's been a pleasure to chat. Next time we'll try and talk about me as well.
I think that was the plan.
It's all about
the plan, babe. You let me down a path.
But if you've enjoyed listening, and I hope you have, but thank you for joining us. Leon's social media Twitter handle is Leon Lloyd 13. Chat to me, Lewis Moody 7 on Twitter or Instagram. If you've got any questions, please throw them out there. We've got some wonderful guests coming up in the coming weeks. Get on there, rate and review, and subscribe to After the Whistle. And as always, After the Whistle is produced in conjunction with Audioboom.
Stay frosty.
Stay frosty. I think we should have a sign off.
Stay frosty.
Stay frosty.